Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's ambitious second-term agenda to reduce the deficit, reform the tax code, fix immigration, and free us from foreign oil. Ed Kilgore, the author of the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog, joins us to discuss what is possible, doable, and likely to be achieved with a gridlocked government largely unchanged by the recent $6 billion election. Then we will look into how Wall Street will deal with Obama's second term, given their big losing bet on Romney. Jeff Connaughton, the author of The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins, joins us. He previously worked on Wall Street and as a special assistant to then-chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Joe Biden, and we will assess what can be done to clear the backlog of judicial appointments blocked by the Republicans. Then finally, we will speak with Alan Lichtman, the distinguished professor of history at American University, who has correctly predicted the outcomes of all presidential elections since 1984, including last Tuesday's. He is the author of White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and we'll examine the changing electorate since Romney won 6 out of every 10 white votes, but still lost. Joining us now is Ed Kilgore, the principal writer for the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He is also the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council and communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ed Kilgore.
Thank you.
And what do you think of the president's... A fairly ambitious agenda there that he sort of rattled off in his victory speech, reducing the deficit, reforming the tax code, fixing immigration, freeing us from foreign oil. All of the above or some of the above? What do you think?
Well, I think much of the above is part of his agenda. Obviously, he's beginning a chess game, with Republicans who still have some leverage in Congress. Tell you the truth, what interested me about his speech was a couple of things that you didn't mention. He talked about global warming, which because of the bipartisan fixation on coal counties in Virginia and Ohio during the general election, is a subject that never got raised. And secondly, he talked about fixing our electoral system, which is a bit of unfinished business from 2000 that's desperately needed for the future, fixing our electoral system and establishing some sort of national voting rights. So I give him a little more credit for an even more ambitious agenda than you talked about. But, yeah, sure, he won. He has to appear a bit above the fray right now, but I do think he's got some forward momentum now.
And the fixing the voting, of course, is difficult because it's a state-run operation, and we're witnessing Florida. I think they've finally resolved that Obama won Florida, but yet another embarrassment there. What's the possibility then? You're suggesting that you can fix it in terms of voting rights, but what about access and confidence in the vote?
Well, I think, the last time this was attempted after 2000 produced the Help America Vote Act, which was frankly, an underwhelming set of grants to states to improve their voting systems, along with a framework, including provisional ballots, which helped a little bit. The most important thing we can do going forward is to make sure that the Voting Rights Act stays in place, which affects, frankly, discriminated against voters all over the country. It has particular impact in my native South. There's both a legislative and a judicial assault on the Voting Rights Act underway. That needs to be preserved. But I do think with a variety of carrots and sticks, we could come pretty close to finally establishing a national system of voting rights. The time to do it is right after an election, when frankly, even Republicans are a little bit ashamed of what some of their officials were doing.
So, Ed Kilgore, What about the elections, though? That's the big change in terms of how the Republicans must be seeing the writing on the wall now, that you can't have a party built around grumpy old white men. 20 women senators just got elected, almost all of them Democrats. The young and the minority showed up in droves. So the demographics are clearly indicating a very strong future for the Democrats and a very dubious future for the Republicans.
Well, the problem is twofold. First of all, Republicans, this particular generation of Republicans is really fixated on maintaining a conservative ideology, maybe even intensifying it, you know, on grounds that the reason Romney lost was that he was an insufficiently authentic or convincing conservative. So they'll look for any excuse to avoid a significant ideological change. And the second problem is that, whereas you're right, the demographic writing is on the wall, it's slow and uneven. And, you know, what happened on Tuesday is that a presidential electorate, which is more composed of younger and non-white voters than a midterm electorate, showed up again. But in 2014, all other things being equal, we're likely to see an older and whiter electorate like we did in 2010. It's always been this way, by the way. It's just that now it's midterm versus presidential turnout patterns happen to be perfectly aligned with the two parties. So Republicans are probably going to think they can get by, at least through 2014, pretty much behaving the way they are now. Maybe they'll learn to speak Spanish. Maybe they'll get some younger, brighter spokespeople. But I don't think they've quite decided that their ideology dooms them, and I'm not sure that a lot of them would change it even then. That's the problem.
Again, I'm speaking with Ed Kilgore, the principal writer for the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He's also managing editor of the Democratic Strategist and senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council and communications director for United States Senator Sam Nunn. So much of the details, of course, the devil's in the details in terms of the president's broad agenda here to reduce the deficit, reform the tax code, fix immigration, and free us from foreign oil. In terms of the latter, it seems that foreign policy, he'll have a stronger hand. I think he's certainly not in any way beholden to Netanyahu, who, along with Adelson and Karl Rove and the Koch brothers, seem to be the biggest losers. But how do you think, is that something you can really, really jumpstart with presidential leadership like Jack Kennedy did with vowing to take somebody to the moon? I mean, is that what it requires, a Manhattan Project, to really get us off Middle East oil and off carbon?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to take a multi-year, multi-administration effort that frankly has to begin with a return of bipartisanship on this topic, which has been, I mean, the really pathetic thing is how quickly and thoroughly it's been lost. You know, people forget that John McCain was for years the one of the principal sponsors of cap and trade legislation, which when Obama offered it was suddenly this terrible socialist idea. And the climate change denial faction within the Republican Party took over very rapidly. So, there's certain things the president can do through executive action that will really help. It would be nice if he would go back to talking about it again. It was pretty much absent during the 2012 campaign. You know, but ultimately the Republican Party is going to have to come to its senses on this, to make progress possible, and I'm not seeing a whole lot of signs that it's likely.
So in terms of shuffling the deck, Ed Kilgore, in terms of a new cabinet, what do you think? Obviously, Hillary Clinton is going to step down, and frankly, I'm pretty sure she's going to run in 2016. I can't imagine that she doesn't want to be to break that glass ceiling and be the first female president of the United States. But you know, that's just my opinion. What about, you know, Geithner? Not exactly the most popular guy, particularly amongst progressive Democrats. What's your sense of what's going to happen in terms of the cabinet shuffle?
Well, I don't have any detailed insider knowledge of how it's going to all work out, and I think a lot of people are now just coming up for air. I think Geithner is definitely gone. I think Holder is going to leave. I think there are quite a few exhausted cabinet officials that will either go or move around. But I don't have a detailed list. I don't sit around listening to the scuttlebutt, but I definitely think there'll be new leadership at Treasury, at Justice, and a significant shifting around. I think there may be some cabinet members that move from one post to another and a little bit of fresh blood. If I had to guess right now, John Kerry is clearly the front runner for State Department, and you know, there's a lot of speculation that Janet Napolitano, the current Homeland Security Secretary, could wind up as Attorney General.
Well, if you have somebody in the Attorney General's seat who's a little more aggressive on Wall Street than Holder has been, if you have somebody at Treasury who stands up against Wall Street more than Geithner, and you've got Elizabeth Warren now in the Senate, do you think that means that, I mean, they made this big bet on Romney, didn't they, Wall Street? So,
They absolutely did. And it'll be interesting to see if all this sort of anticipatory whining coming from Wall Street and the financial industry, you know, about being treated so poorly by the Obama administration returns to a little bit of realism now that they're looking ahead to 4 years. It's a fascinating thought. Clearly, there will be a more aggressive Democratic Senate caucus than there was over the last few years. And in general, I mean, you can put too much emphasis on psychology and dynamics and mood, but there is no question that when you start comparing things like the fiscal negotiations, the atmosphere is rather different than it was 2 years ago when you had just seen this enormous Republican landslide and Democrats were on their heels. The administration and Democrats generally not only have the wind behind their backs in terms of a presidential victory and gaining seats in the Senate and in the House, but they have a little bit more leverage when it comes to these so-called fiscal cliff negotiations coming up. I think progressives who have been disappointed with Obama and Democrats generally are going to feel a little bit better, I think, with what's going to happen the next few months.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here, Ed Kilgore.
No problem.
Again, I've been speaking with Ed Kilgore, the principal writer for the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He's also the managing editor of the Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council and communications director for United States Senator Sam Nunn. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about how Wall Street lost a big bet on Romney.
Yeah, it seems like. Yeah, it feels like. Yeah, it seems like. Yeah, it feels like. Feels like a brand new day. A brand new day.
Of this republic they rewrite, and now a few own everything in sight. They own it free of liability. They own, but they are not like you and me. Their influence dictates legality.
And until the upstart.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jeff Connaughton, the author of The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins. He previously worked for 4 years as an investment banker, first at Smith Barney and then at E.F. Hutton. And he served as a special assistant to the counsel to the president in the Clinton White House, and then as special assistant to then Chairman Joseph Biden of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and later as chief of staff for Senator Ted Kaufman. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Connaughton.
Thank you, Ian.
And the president outlined a fairly ambitious agenda for the next 4 years in his victory speech. He talked about that we have to solve these challenges together, reducing our deficit, reforming our tax code, fixing our immigration system, freeing ourselves from foreign oil. We've got work to do. That's it in a nutshell. Any sense on your part that that's too ambitious? Because a lot of his critics have suggested that in his first term he was far too conciliatory, he reached out too much, he actually apparently believes in compromise and bipartisanship. But one would think that after this first bruising 4 years and this bruising campaign, maybe he might take Harry Reid's advice stated yesterday that we're not going to be pushed around.
Well, you know, again, he's going to have to negotiate with the same House Republican leadership and which has a Tea Party faction within it that hasn't changed much. So the real question is, has the dynamic facing the president changed so much? I mean, you know, frankly, a lot of people on the progressive side of the equation are concerned that he's going to be too conciliatory and he's going to reach a deal that, you know, will cut entitlement programs and, you know, begin to solve our deficit problem on the backs of the people who can least afford it. So that's going to be tricky, and no one can really say, you know, how that negotiation is going to come forward. You know, Boehner, the House Speaker, stepped forward and said, look, you know, we have an electoral mandate ourselves as the Republicans who just got reelected. You know, we don't intend on agreeing to any tax rate increases. So, you know, let's see if we have gridlock or let's see if we kick the can down the road on the fiscal cliff. Let's see what Senator Reid does about the Senate rules that will be adopted and whether the filibuster rules will change. It's hard to guess at this point whether the president can really be that much more successful than he has been in the past 2 years if you have an obstinate Republican House obstructing him.
So, Jeff Connaughton, your recent book, The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins, obviously leads me to question whether or not they won, given that most of their money went to Romney. I suppose it's a bit like the casino, the house always wins. But what's your sense of, are there some glum faces on Wall Street?
Without a doubt. I mean, they went all in for Romney. They wanted a president who would repeal the Dodd-Frank Act. They wanted a new president who would appoint regulators who were even closer to the banks than the ones Obama appointed, which is hard for me to imagine, frankly. And so, yes, I mean, I think Wall Street didn't get the victory. They didn't get to go on the offensive and sort of repealing some of what they didn't like in the Dodd-Frank Act. But, you know, what does that mean? You know, does that mean we're going to find that the president appoints a Treasury Secretary, assuming Tim Geithner leaves, who's going to be tough on the banks? I'm skeptical. Are we going to get a new attorney general, assuming Eric Holder leaves for the second term, who is determined to prosecute Wall Street executives for crimes? I hope so. You know, we can only hope. But again, I'm skeptical. I mean, I think Wall Street, you know, while it may have been the president's last campaign, it wasn't the last campaign for the Democratic Party. And yeah, Wall Street's going to start doing what it does, which is, you know, making sure that it's got influence and a seat at the table in Washington, because you know, we're going to have another important election just 2 years from now, and they've got big pockets.
Well, your former boss, for whom you were chief of staff, Senator Ted Kaufman, who succeeded Joe Biden and who was not beholden to lobbyists and was therefore, one of those rare senators who can actually work and vote in terms of his conscience. And he, more than anybody, I think, pushed through the Consumer Protection Agency that Elizabeth Warren started, or at least suggested. And now, of course, she's been elected to the United States Senate. Does that give you any sense that at least that firewall against Wall Street, which the Republicans tried their very hardest to undo, will that stand and perhaps grow?
Yes. I mean, I'd give the president credit for the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. He did favor it from the beginning. It was Elizabeth Warren's idea. That wasn't really a Ted Kaufman accomplishment. I mean, what Ted did was he put the banks on the defensive by going against the too big to fail banks to break them up, and that sort of gave breathing space to Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. But what's great about Senator Elizabeth Warren being elected is I think Ted showed that even one senator, one determined senator, and there were other reformer senators too working with Ted, but you know, even one senator can really do a lot to sort of change the balance of the way we look at Wall Street issues. And she's going to be able to do a tremendous amount, I mean, especially if she's on the banking committee. So I think Wall Street really does feel like they lost a lot when Scott Brown lost to Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts. And I hope she invigorates the debate in a way that reverberates with the Obama administration. I mean, you know, you have to be tough on your own party, you know, to make sure your own party is doing the right thing when it comes to Wall Street issues. And that's what Ted did, and I think that's what Elizabeth Warren will do.
So let's turn again to Jeff Connaughton, the author of The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins. Previously worked for 4 years as an investment banker, first at Smith Barney and then at E.F. Hutton, and then he served as a special assistant to the counsel to the president in the Clinton White House, and then a special assistant to then Chairman Joseph Biden of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and later as chief of staff for Senator Ted Kaufman. So having worked on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Jeff Connaughton, clearly there's an enormous backlog of judicial appointments, and the judiciary in this country has been skewed to the right by a dominance of Republican presidents, and not to mention the Supreme Court, which hangs in the balance. My understanding is that the backlog of judicial appointees nominated by President Obama is something of a record, and many critics say he hasn't really been sufficiently vigorous in pushing it through. Since he's got to play so much catch-up, do you expect the playing field in terms of our judiciary to be leveled in these next 4 years?
Well, I mean, what the Republicans used to do when the Senate was in the majority hands of the Democrats and we had a Democratic president was they would only filibuster those judicial nominees who they thought were too liberal or, you know, in their view, for the bench. What was happening in the past 2 years is they were filibustering every judicial nominee. I mean, it would, you know, some nominees would be tied up for 6 months, and then when they finally got a vote, because the Republicans allowed it, they'd pass 99-0. So the Republicans were filibustering nominees who in the end they had no problem with. So they were just clearly trying to clog the pipeline, slow it down so that, you know, hopefully in their view, they could get a new president in and they'd be, you know, be in control of who got picked as judges. So they're going to have to find some way to let that pipeline open up for the next couple of years at least, because we have to have a functioning judiciary. And I do agree, you know, there were a couple of times when there were nominees who were perfectly fine, qualified judicial nominees who, you know, the president didn't push for. But people used to say the same thing about President Clinton, you know, that he didn't push hard enough for certain liberal nominees. I mean, it's a question of where do you want to spend your political capital? And, you know, if you appoint centrist judges that are still good on, you know, legal issues Democrats care about the most, then you can get most of those through. But if you try to go you know, to the left and really appoint, you know, the ones the Republicans don't like, then you're going to have a problem. But I think, you know, Senator Reid has said he wants to change the filibuster rules in some way. So far, he's only indicated in how they apply to the motion to proceed to a bill. You can filibuster twice, both on the motion to proceed and on the bill itself, and that really slows down the Senate's ability to get any work done when the Republicans are filibustering every bill. But he hasn't yet talked about whether he would change it for judicial nominees. And it wasn't that long ago that, you know, the Republicans, when they were in the majority, were thinking about changing it, and that was called the so-called nuclear option. I mean, I think you're going to find Republicans getting very geared up about sending the message, you know, you would really poison the well if you change the filibuster rules for judicial nominees. But, you know, maybe Reid's going to do that. Maybe, you know, it's only going to, I mean, the way he envisions doing it is with a 51-vote majority adopting new Senate rules on the first day the Senate comes in session. So he doesn't need any Republican votes, but, you know, next time the Republicans are in control, you know, and we're in the minority, we'll regret it. That's the trade-off.
Well, it sounds like something's got to break the logjam. Certainly the indications from the minority leader, Mitch McConnell, aren't encouraging. Something has to happen, and, you know, maybe...
Well, here you have senators who were just elected campaigning against the filibuster. I mean, so there's even a mandate. I mean, Angus King, the independent who was elected in Maine, I mean, he was saying the Senate's broken. It's not in the Constitution to require a 60-vote margin to get anything done in the Senate. So there are going to be some very strong-minded senators there saying, you know, we need to rethink this. You know, we need to be able to function more effectively. But, you know, it does tend to make the Senate more like the House, you know, in that, yes, you still have two per state, but if it's only a majority vote, you know, that doesn't protect the rights of the minority.
Well, but I don't think that you can shame the Republicans into doing the right thing, can you? I don't see
any... That's the big question. I don't think Republicans have changed their stripes at all. I mean, I maybe because of the election, they have to look like they're going to be more willing to work, and McConnell's already said if the president's willing to meet us halfway in true bipartisanship, then we'll work with him. But, you know, the problem is, as he also said on his 60 Minutes interview with Senator Reid last week, you know, he just doesn't believe in where the president and the Democrats want to take the country. So, you know, I'm not sure they're going to be any more willing or able to find common ground when you have these deep disagreements about tax and spending and just about every other issue.
Well, Jeff Conniton, though, they had their way with George Bush. They got everything almost they wanted. Remember, when George Bush came back for his second term, he said, I've got political capital and I'm going to spend it. And
well, he tried to privatize Social Security,
right.
And Senator Reid opposed him every step of the way. And thank goodness he did. You know, I mean, if we had privatized Social Security before the financial crisis, it would have been a disaster, you know, for everyone who, you know, wants Social Security to be there in your retirement age. So,
right, but I think the broader point being, though, that everything, when the Republicans got their chance under George W. Bush, it was ruinous, both domestically and in terms of foreign policy, and they haven't come up with any other suggestions, and I think the American people noticed that and voted Obama back in.
Right, that was the most interesting confirmation from the exit polls, that people really do judge the Obama administration in the context of how poorly President Bush had done and how bad off the country was when Bush handed the keys over to the new president. So, you know, I think people do see this as, okay, we've come some distance in pulling ourselves out of this recession. The economy is moving forward, and so the president deserves another 4 years to continue his ideas.
So just in closing then, Jeff Connaughton, given the president's ambitious agenda here to reduce the deficit, reform our tax code and fix our immigration system and free us from foreign oil, the one that that Democrats are worried about is reducing our deficit. And even Bill Clinton has talked about Simpson bowls in very positive terms. And, you know, already a lot of the debate about Social Security has been distorted. They talk to it as they refer to it as an entitlement program, when in fact it's paid for, and it always has been, and it could be modified to have the wealthy pay a little bit more. That'll make it much more solid. So there's many things about the Democratic traditions, if you will, going back to FDR, the very bedrock of the identity of the Democratic Party, if indeed it has an identity, which many say that it's sort of lost its way. I can't imagine why a group of Democrats, with the mandate that Obama's been given and which the Senate's been given, would be in any way in a mood to compromise and in any way eviscerate Social Security. That would be like a form of unnecessary. Well, I guess suicide's unnecessary to begin with, but you see what I'm saying? I mean,
oh, absolutely. I mean, again, if you look at it, you know, our current problems in the context of what happened during the Bush presidency, I mean, these deficits are primarily a product of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and expanding prescription Medicare Part D all on a credit card. You know, after Bush had cut taxes for everyone, we went on this gigantic spending spree, you know, well before the president took office. So now are we supposed to balance, you know, solving the deficits on the backs of people who, you know, have paid into Social Security and rely on Medicare? I mean, you know, the progressives are going to go crazy if the president compromises in that direction. But that's the box that he's, you know, about to be forced into. And frankly, I don't see any of his advisors, you know, he's not being advised by people like Robert Reich and Paul Krugman, you know, who say, look, austerity, you know, made things worse in Europe. I mean, the only way to get this economy growing again is to, you know, not worry about the deficits for another year or so, and to actually, you know, I think Senator Schumer, you know, called for more stimulus today for, you know, the Northeast after Sandy, but others are going to say we have to address the deficits now, and the fiscal cliff is looming.
Well, there's some serious losers in this campaign. If you think of Sheldon Adelson and Karl Rove and even Netanyahu, and I think, you know, I would like to be able to add to the list Pete Peterson, who's on this one-man campaign as the leading deficit hawk. And he spent a lot of money to convince people that the sky is falling. And I must say, I don't find a Wall Street billionaire to be the most credible person in terms of telling us that we all should tighten our belts while those on Wall Street don't tighten theirs.
I mean, Citizens United had us all scared that money was going to buy this election, and it didn't. And that's hopeful. I mean, the president was raising gigantic amounts of money in the fall, primarily from small donors, which is, it's reassuring. You know, we do have a democracy, and we do have the ability to fund presidential campaigns with a lot of people giving small contributions. And that's what will dilute the power of the plutocracy that has come all too close to taking over in Washington.
Well, Jeff Connaughton, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jeff Connaughton, who's the author of The Payoff, Why Wall Street Always Wins. He previously worked for 4 years as an investment banker, first at Smith Barney and then at E.F. Hutton. Additionally, he served as special assistant to the counsel to the president in the Clinton White House and then as special assistant to then-chairman Joseph Biden of the Senate Judiciary Committee and later as chief of staff for Senator Ted Kaufman. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with an historian who accurately predicted the Obama sweep.
Changes. Don't tell them to blow up on Olivet. Changes. Changes. Where's the shame you've left is up to our next event. Now make change be.
senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall, for he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls, for the times they are a-changing.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alan Lichtman, the Distinguished Professor of History at American University, who has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the latest just concluded. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you, Ian.
And how many victory laps have you been doing, Alan? I mean,
mostly been doing some sleeping after an all-night election eve, but I have to say this is now 8 elections in a row. Actual advance prediction, not a claim that, you know, I've accounted backwards for elections. Backwards, the keys to the White House go all the way to 1860, but forward, the keys to the White House have anticipated the outcomes of every election since 1984, often years ahead of time. And no other system has anything close to this kind of record. And as you know, because you heard me say it on your air, I first predicted the 2012 election in an article in the International Journal of Information Systems in January 2010, nearly 3 years ago. The keys can do this, unlike any other system, because they're not based on polls or anything like that. They are based on what actually drives and explains elections, and that is governing, not campaigning. The keys are a gauge of whether or not the party holding the White House has governed well enough to get 4 more years. There are 13 of them, and if the party holding the White House loses 6 or more, they're out. And often way ahead of time, you can discern how the keys are likely to turn. And as of January 2010, I only had 4 keys turned against the party in power. And that gave them a 2-key cushion. And ultimately, after the elimination of bin Laden, I only had 3 keys turned against the party in power. And as you know, I stuck to this with all of the ups and downs in the polls, the Obama meltdown in the first debate. I insisted you've got to keep your eye on the big picture, that it's the fundamentals of governing, not the day-to-day events of campaigning that counts.
So, Alan, let's also talk about your other book, White Protestant Nation,
yes,
The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, because nationally, Romney won the white vote 59% to 39%. So Romney won 6 out of every 10 white voters, but still lost. What happened?
A couple of things are happening, and this is really important. I'm glad you brought it up. Number one, you used to be able to win easily with the Republican base, which is the white Protestant base, and conservative white Catholics. But that's a shrinking demographic base. The nation, number one, is becoming increasingly non-white. Everybody has commented on that. That's nothing new, although I've been commenting on it since my book in 2008. By mid-century, we're going to be a majority non-white country. Texas is already majority non-white, and their politics is going to change over the next generation. California's majority non-white. But there's a second thing that no one has talked about. More and more Americans are becoming non-religious. They don't strongly identify with any particular religion. That's also a rising segment of the electorate. And that is not a group that Republicans are likely to tap into. So doubly, they're working against the grain of American demographics and trends in American religion. There's also something else operating here that nobody has touched upon. More than at any time since the 1920s, and you know this well, Ian, the Republican Party is the party of American conservatives. There used to be a lot of conservative Southern Democrats in the Democratic Party. They're all gone. Conservatism is now embedded within the Republican Party. But conservatism, as I wrote in my book, White Protestant Nation, in 2008, is imploding from within. It's not something the Democrats are doing to conservatives. The conservatives' problem is there are deep contradictions within the conservative political philosophy that they're completely unwilling to face up to. Let me give you just a couple of simple examples. Conservatives claim to be the party of fiscal responsibility and limited government. But who built the biggest, most expensive, most intrusive government in the history of the United States? George W. Bush, certainly the most conservative president we've had since the 1920s, even more conservative than Ronald Reagan. He increased spending more in his first term than Bill Clinton did in all of Bill Clinton's two terms. The deficit went down under Bill Clinton. It ballooned under George W. Bush, even in times of relative prosperity, before the economy began to melt down in 2008. Second example, conservatives claim to be the party of states' rights. And yet, if you read their platform, they want a constitutional amendment, right-to-life amendment, that would eliminate the ability of any given state to set its policy on abortion. If you look back to George W. Bush, he quashed regulations in California designed to reduce carbon emissions, not allowing the states to set their policies there. Final simple example. Conservatives have always claimed to be against, and they hate this the most, social engineering, right? We're not going to social engineer to solve poverty. We're not going to social engineer to repair the healthcare system. And yet in Iraq and Afghanistan, they've engaged in arguably the biggest social engineering programs in the history of America, not even here in the United States, but in much more distant and foreign cultures. And finally, there's this huge split over immigration between the business conservatives who favor immigration reform and bringing in lots of people with skills and expertise, and the staunch ethnocentric social conservatives who want to crack down on illegal immigrants and close our doors. Those are four contradictions that run to the heart of the conservative movement, and they haven't even begun to address them, much less resolve them.
And indeed, the contradiction of being against social engineering in the United States, but through drive-by democracy and undeclared and unnecessary wars, we're trying to impose it on Muslim countries that are resisting the American empire. Nothing more absurd than fixing potholes in Kabul and not fixing potholes in Main Street, USA.
Exactly. So, and, you know, as I said, the leaders of the movement haven't even begun to address it. If you read the commentary, you know, it's like putting a Band-Aid over a cannon wound. You know, we got to reach out more to minorities. We got to have more minority faces. We got to have a better message. We have to have better. None of this is even remotely approaching the deep and enduring problems that conservatism faces. And until they confront those problems, they're not going to solve anything.
Again, I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, the distinguished professor of history at American University. Both of his books are very, very topical at the moment, White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the latest just concluded. Now, you mentioned that Texas is a non-white state and America will soon be a non-white country. With a non-white majority, I should say. Texas, of course, the Tea Party basically got wiped out in most cases around the country. But in Texas, they managed to elect Ted Cruz, one of their Tea Party favorites and a rising star.
Yes, Hispanic. But let me tell you what's happening in Texas. And the reason why Texas is still a solidly red state is, number one, the overwhelming minority there is, of course, Hispanics. And a lot of the Hispanics are not yet citizens. And a lot of them who are citizens are not yet mobilized to vote. It's a slow process, but it will change. I can't tell you when, but at some point, maybe 20 years from now, Texas will go from a red state to a purple state. That is, it will become a competitive state once enough Latinos are citizens and once enough of the citizen Latinos register and vote. It's not going to happen overnight, but it is going to happen over the long run. And if Republicans you know, can't have Texas as a solidly red state. Their long-term future as a party is grim.
Well, you mentioned, Alan Lichtman, in effect, that what the Republicans are now saying, a few of their more moderate voices are saying, we've got to reach out to Hispanics and women and the young. But everything that I'm hearing from them is essentially is they're treating it as a public relations problem.
Exactly. That's the point I made. Exactly, yeah. Right. It's like putting a Band-Aid over a cannon. We need to have, you know, better messages to the media, better rhetoric. We need more Latino and black faces to present at our meetings. That will do them absolutely zero good. You know, Latinos and other minorities, they're smart. They're asking, how do your policies affect our lives? And on every level, from tax policy to deregulation, to a welfare policy, to immigration policy, to education policy, Republican policies are inimical to Latinos. So just, you know, changing the PR face of the party, as you correctly point out, will do absolutely nothing.
And Bill O'Reilly, his postmortem is that the Democrats won because the people that vote Democrat just want stuff from the government. I'm quoting him.
Yeah, we've been hearing that, you know, from conservatives since the New Deal. Roosevelt won in 1936.
Right.
One prominent Republican said, you can't beat Santa Claus.
So, in other words, there's not much evidence that the Republicans are really learning and that they're really interested in changing their policies.
No, and this is, you know, a pivotal moment for Republicans, really. And this is a chance for the kind of rebuilding effort that actually did after the Goldwater defeat in 1964. It took a while, but during the 70s, with the Heritage Foundation, Phyllis Schlafly's Stop ERA, the Conservative Caucus, NCPAC, the Business Roundtable, both ideologically and structurally, the Republican Party truly rebuilt and rebuilt under adversity, but there's absolutely zero sign that they're going to replicate that in the early 21st century.
So, Alan Lichtman, given the demographic realities, and what kind of country do you think will be in, say, 2016, when a lot of the punditry is suggesting it'll be Hillary Clinton versus Jeb Bush?
Well, that's going to be a very interesting election, obviously, presuming that's the case, and the chances are it won't be. I can't tell you who it will be, but any given prediction is likely to be wrong, although I do think the Hillary Clinton side is more likely. That's going to be an interesting election because, again, Jeb Bush is considered among all top Republican leaders, with the exception of, you know, Marco Rubio, who is himself Hispanic, the white Republican who has done the best job of building support with Hispanics. So that'll be a real test of whether
he's married to a Colombian woman.
I don't think it will be.
He's married to a Colombian woman, I believe.
Exactly. I don't think that's enough. You know, it's interesting. The conservatives for decades have been blasting Democrats for identity politics, you know, for blacks who are voting for black office holders, for appealing, you know, on the basis of ethnicity or race. And yet that seems to be the only answer Republicans have for their dilemma with non-whites is to replicate identity politics. It's, you know, one of the great ironies of this very shallow debate that's going on within conservatism. They should read my book and see what they did in the 1970s when they really rebuilt their party and rebuilt, or at least ideas to some extent, but they're not coming close to that now.
So the other statistic that was surprising, given that Paul Ryan, just before the election, made that extraordinary statement to the evangelicals in a phone call hosted by Ralph Reed, where he said that Obama is apt to destroy Judeo-Christian Western civilization values. And
I thought Franklin Roosevelt had done that already, but let that go.
Well, it was such an absurd mouthful.
Of course.
But in terms of the Judeo part of it, 70% of American Jews voted for Obama. Only 30% voted for Romney. And that's in spite of all the money that Adelson and all the, the Netanyahu weighing in. And so
yeah,
there's some real serious losers in this one. Karl Rove. Adelson, Netanyahu, and Paul Ryan, the Tea Party favorite.
Couldn't have happened to a nicer group of guys, I have to tell you. You know, these are hardball politicians, every single one of them, who play, you know, life and death politics. And they all lost, and that's the way it goes. You know, they reveled in their hardball win in 2000, and in a sense they deserved it because they played better politics than the Al Gore people. Well, now they're outplayed, and they are a dying breed. They're fighting against the trends of America, the religious and demographic trends. And what worked in 2000 and barely worked in 2004 has no chance of working in 2016. They've got to do something different.
So does that mean that hope is a more has a better chance than fear? Because I think, you know, if you'd break it down in the simplest terms, those that voted for Obama were giving him a second chance at hope and change, and those that voted for Romney were motivated by, you know, xenophobia and fear. And maybe you got some better analysis than I do.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was certainly some of that. I think that may be a little overstated. But regardless of that, let me argue, xenophobia worked for a very long time in American politics. You know, it worked in the 1920s when we got the Immigration Restriction Law of 1924, which essentially shut out my ancestors, the Jews and Catholics from Eastern and Southern Europe. And that endured till 1965. That wasn't repealed. But it doesn't work anymore because the base is too small. You know, the Karl Rove strategy is do whatever it takes, whether it's fear or ethnocentrism, to rally the base. And that very barely worked for two elections. It's never going to work again for Republicans because they have the shrinking base, which also explains why Republicans are so anxious to engage in these rigorous voter ID laws to cut out early voting, because they realize they can't grow their base. But maybe they can prevent parts of the Democratic base from voting. But these were such outlandish efforts that virtually every court that reviewed them struck them down, many of them including judges appointed by Republicans. It wasn't partisan courts at all. In the Texas case, I think it was two of three judges had been appointed by Republicans.
So I mentioned earlier that Bill O'Reilly's postmortem of the election is that the people voted for the Democrats because they want stuff. But the real question now is, will this second term of Obama's, will he be tougher than he was in terms of his first term, where he really did apparently believe in reaching out and finding compromise or even bipartisanship? I suspect he's learned his lesson. But one of the big lies of American politics is, apropos what O'Reilly's saying about how the left operates on patronage through social programs, the truth of the matter is that the right in this country operates on patronage due to government programs that are essentially socialist, but because it's largely military spending and agribusiness, it's not noticed,
military spending, agribusiness, and corporate subsidies, guarantees, and tax breaks.
Right. So when are we going to have that debate to at least explode the myth that we have right-wing welfare in this country? We don't have what social democracies have. We have this peculiar capitalist corporate version of welfare.
Well, you know, the guys who kind of attacked that but really weren't much listened to were Ralph Nader, of course. In 2000, he wasn't much listened to. He had his own flaws as a candidate. Another very flawed guy, but who has pointed some of this out, coming from the other side of the political spectrum, of course, is Ron Paul. And, you know, he got nowhere with this argument. It's a very tough argument to address. And when are we going to address the fact that today 5% of Americans control 40% of the national wealth? There has been a multi-trillion dollar transfer of wealth from 90% of us to 10% of us over the last 30 years. Multi-trillion dollar transfer of wealth. And finally, are we ever going to address the issue of climate change and the environment? I think, you know, those three issues, which we haven't even begun to address, much less resolve, may be the biggest challenges of the 21st century.
Well, just in closing, Alan Klingman,
given what you just said, what about, though, the other change that needs to be done in America, and that is to restore our democracy and our economy, which is becoming a kind of corporate plutonomy, and our democracy is largely in the process of being captured by oligarchs.
You're asking me to resolve all our problems.
No, I'm not asking you to resolve it. I'm suggesting.
I've long been an advocate of complete public financing of campaigns, I think. Right. Both parties are in the grip of the big money interests. Of course, you have to change the Constitution or radically change the Supreme Court to do it. And the truth is, you know, we're not going to change much the corporate economy until we get rid of the subsidies, the guarantees, the tax breaks, the legal protections. All that has to go. And there has to be a much more robust and progressive labor movement in the United States. The union movement is almost dead.
Well, Alan, the reason I brought it up was that Wall Street gave all their money to Romney this time, and they're not used to losing. But are they going to learn anything from that, do you think?
I hope, you know, that they'll learn something. You know, they tend not to. But the truth is, Wall Street will do just fine under Obama. If you look at the statistics, in fact, the stock market goes up more under Democratic presidents than Republican presidents. The economy goes up more under Democratic presidents than Republican presidents, and unemployment is lower under Democratic presidents than Republican presidents. That's just a fact. Those, you know, those are well-known, well-published statistics. So my final note is, don't worry about Wall Street.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who is a distinguished professor of history at American University. He has studied both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, including the latest one just concluded. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And the conversation continues at Facebook/IanMastersMedia. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline.